lacks the LSI devices that make microcomputers so relatively inexpensive. All this is transparent to the user. Programming and other computer science concepts have remained essentially constant over the years. I would estimate that it will be at least 5 years or more before maintenance cost for our AE will exceed the replacement cost. And I think that application deficiencies should not be noticeable for an even longer period of time. This should be true of today's hobby computers, although their technical life is going to be relatively short. I think their useful life in application in the school scene will continue for 5, 10, or even more years. Such long life is not true for many businesses and industrial applications where other factors such as throughput have extreme importance. But at the moment anyway, the low sophistication requirements of pre-college educational use, I think, argues for a relatively long life and a fairly safe investment. Might mention something about our teacher in service. We went into this about a year ago knowing absolutely nothing about computer science. Our teachers did have a background in programming, some Fortran in pre-service education. They had all mathematics teachers I'm talking about, had largely all picked up BASIC by last year. But that was about the extent of our background. But microcomputing, you see, is still a little bit different than just turning on a timeshare terminal and expecting it to go. The teacher operator of the microcomputer system needs to know how you load the BASIC interpreter into the machine, because when you power down, even if it's only a power failure, you lose everything in your memory. What is a bootstrap? What is a loader? What is a dumper? How are computer memories organized? How do computers compute? What does the front panel do? If you don't have a front panel but a video display, what is a monitor? What does it do? And so forth. Because of these needs in operating a microcomputer system at the moment, although we're very close now to having a box that you just turn on and it works. In fact, you can do that now with ROMs, but the trouble with ROMs is that they're quite expensive. It'll still cost you $500, $600, $700, $800 to store 8K of BASIC on ROM. And when you consider how you might otherwise spend the money, especially when you're trying to implement a fairly large-scale instructional computer program in your school system, you think very seriously about spending the $800 in other ways than having your BASIC on prom. Because of these special requirements then at the moment for operating microcomputer systems, we contacted the People's Computer Company in Menlo Park, California. This is Bob Albrecht's center of operation. For 9 2-hour sessions every Monday after school, we contracted with People's Computer Company to provide our mathematics and any other interested teacher with some background information on microcomputing and microcomputers. So we had about 35 teachers in our district attending Monday afternoon meetings from 4 to 6 o'clock for 9 consecutive Mondays. The experience was so worthwhile that the teachers almost unanimously requested that we continue this experience in the spring. And so we're just completing another 9-week session of microcomputing in the classroom. And it's been extremely rewarding and valuable. And the net result is that our teachers are able to operate these systems in their schools without calling upon any outside help. And they are beginning to think of some very interesting curricular developments coming out of all of this. Next year, many of our teachers hope to participate in a National Science Foundation-funded Microcomputer Teacher In-Service Institute, which we hope will be conducted by the Lawrence Hall of Science. They have submitted a proposal. We're very hopeful that the proposal will be accepted by National Science Foundation. To our knowledge, this is the only one or two such institution proposals that has been submitted to NSF for next year in the area of microcomputing, and so we have high hopes. Perhaps many of you know that NSF has finally gotten back into the in-service institute programs. Well, let me conclude then by simply saying that when anybody asks you where it started right here. And I think that's a good feeling upon which to end. We really are in a revolution. We are in the year 2AA. I think that's a very exciting place to be. Thank you very much.
The existence of extrasensory perception between human beings and machines. I think I will let those drop for a minute and come back. I thought I noticed a little expression of skepticism. But I promise that before I sit down, I'll try to supply some sort of evidence for that. Before that, what I really want to talk about, in fact, what brings all of us together here, is the third of that triumvirate of great science fiction concepts that seems to be coming true in an even stranger and more significant manner than the science fiction writers thought about when I first began writing. And that is the robot, or as we know it more familiarly here, the computer. A computer is a machine, and as all of you know, or if you don't, I'm about to tell you, it is the first machine ever built by man that does not amplify either his senses, like a telescope or a TV set, or his muscles, like a hammer or a jet plane, but does in some sense amplify his intelligence. It does it in some very productive ways. One of the sponsors of this group, I will not name him, said just a moment ago that he'd been working with computers for 22 years and had yet to figure out what they were good for. But I know something they're good for. At the Harvard Smithsonian Observatory a few years ago, a fellow named Owen Gingerich had a problem. He had to give a paper to an astronomical gathering. And he had a week to prepare it in. What he decided to do was to repeat the work that Johann Kepler had done in the 17th century, I think, when he first established that the orbit of the planet Mars was an ellipse instead of a circle or whatever other thing people had previously assumed it was. Gingerich had all of Kepler's original observational material. He knew what mathematics Kepler had used. He was going to repeat the process exactly, except that instead of doing it with a goose quill and parchment or whatever Kepler did, he was going to put it on a computer. And so he did. He programmed the computer to duplicate all of Kepler's computations. And the computer clanked along for a while, and in something like 3.5 minutes, it produced the answer, described the orbit of the planet Mars. Well, it had taken Kepler almost 4 years to do the same thing. And it's really only a sort of a parlor trick that one should be able to duplicate the work of somebody 200 or 300 years ago on a computer so much more quickly. But suppose Kepler had had that computer. Suppose he could have used 3 or 4 years out of the most productive part of his life for something other than scribbling figures on parchment. What might he have done that never did get done as a result? And it seems to me that this capacity for amplifying intelligence in some sense can be of great value. I have a daughter, 18 years old now, who's a handicapped child. She was born with a brain injury. She's not severely damaged, but it's hard for her to learn some things. And through her and through organizations of parents with similar children, I've encountered a lot of kids who are what they call learning disabled. And the fundamental characteristic that they all have in common is that it takes them quite a while to learn something. You sit down with them and you teach them arithmetic. You drill it into them over and over again, and by, they can add a column of numbers and get it right. Then you go on to subtraction, and you sit and teach that to them for a while, and by, they get it right. But by then, they've forgotten the addition. This is not unlike most children who go through this sort of process when they're quite young, but the learning disabled children find it much more difficult to get past that stage in their development. They forget. All handicapped children forget, as all very young children forget, and sometimes they forget things that are important. But suppose they had with them a little friendly computer terminal on their wrist, or strapped to their backs, or carried in their pockets, so that when they forgot something that was important, it would remind them. Suppose that if you let them go out by themselves, which you would like to do to help them build a sense of self-sufficiency and confidence, and they came to a street and the light was red and they couldn't remember whether red meant stop or go, they could ask the computer. Suppose that if they got lost, as often they do, they could find out from the computer by telling it the names of the two streets they were at, not only where they were, but how to get from there to the school or wherever they were going. It seems to me this would be a pretty useful thing to have, and it also seems to me that it should not be very far outside the present state of the art. And I think that if such a computer existed, that there would be an opportunity for this sort of person, learning disabled child or the learning disabled adult, to live a much more full and active life than is now possible. And I also think that that's probably a place where a great deal of activity in terms of manufacturing and design is likely to take place. In the title of my talk, it was something about the computer and the robot for fun and profit. Well, that's the profit. This is the growth industry of the future, and I'm letting you all in on the ground floor. And I don't really think that it's just the learning handicapped individual who needs that sort of thing. I think we could all use it. I think all of us would like to have a little machine that would remind us of the things we've forgotten. They exist in science fiction, at any rate. There's one in a story I wrote called The Age of the Pussyfoot. Since I didn't have to worry about designing the hardware, I made it rather attractive. It not only did all the things I described, it reminded you of your mother-in-law's birthday, or your wife's dress size, or girlfriend's, or both. It dispensed perfume, intoxicants, aphrodisiacs, all sorts of things. It was called a Joymaker. And I think that even that, leaving out some of the little cosmetic trappings I put into it, is also just about within the present state of the art as far as hardware is concerned. I don't think it would be too hard to design something that would remind you when a birthday was coming up, help you with that terrible process we all go through this time of year with much soul searching, agony, fear. And here too is a growth industry. But this is all only hardware. I promised to talk about robots, and I would like to say something about a rather more advanced form of computer programming than anything I've mentioned so far, what we all in science fiction have called a robot. I'm not sure that anyone has really defined a robot. It's one of those convenient science fiction terms that we make up to describe something we wish existed. But I think you can define a robot as something which is a mechanical analog of a human being, sharing those capacities that human beings have up until now reserved to themselves. Capacity to reproduce, to feed itself in the environment, to learn, to create, and so on. Far as creating is concerned, you're going to see some of that, so I won't touch on that very much, except to say that Someone was describing to me a computer program for writing poetry, which was a very simple program. In fact, it's so simple that you don't have to have a computer to run it on. You can run it on yourself. I mean, I can do it, and I wasn't even manufactured by IBM. It only consists of picking a word at random in a text and then looking to see that word where it occurs again and writing down the word that follows at that point. And then doing the same. In fact, I wrote a poem like that this afternoon. I wrote it by doing this process with the current issue of the magazine Mother Jones. I arbitrarily decided to take the ninth word in the ninth paragraph on the ninth page to start. And once I found that word, I went on to find it again and then write the word that followed it. This is the poem. Chicago law makes it wood grow, and the investment in a cut a plan. Now, some people might criticize that. They might say it's too short, for one thing. And it lacks some other things that one associates with poetry, meaning, for example. And you can easily say that it's not a very good poem. But most of the human-generated poetry I know can be described in exactly the same terms. So I don't think that it's fair to say that the computer or their computer program can't create just because it doesn't do it very well as yet. Johns Hopkins used to have a machine, I've forgotten the name of it, a little thing about so long, which wandered around battery operated until it ran out of battery, ran down. Then it would find an electric outlet and plug itself in and recharge its batteries. And when it was charged up, it would pull out the plug and emit a sort of an electronic burp and go on to roam around the environment for a while. It did exactly feed itself from the environment. And of course, everyone knows about Turing's engine, the marvelous computer that has never been built, possibly the best designed computer that will never be built, which clearly can be demonstrated to have the capacity for reproducing itself by transferring little bits of information about itself to something that will build a replica of it. It does it in the form of paper tape, and it's a very complex process, and nobody really is ever going to build one, but it shows that it can be done. And if it can be done in that way, there is also the possibility that in some cases, the information it transmits might be a little garbled, so that the duplicate wasn't quite the same as it was. It might even be better in some way. So that if you had a population of these Turing machines, some of them might be better than others, and if they were in any way competitive with each other, you might have what we call the survival of the fittest. And you might, in fact, have evolution of a machine as the weaker ones were crowded out by the stronger ones. And if you put all of these things together, the learning programs like Samuelson's checker-playing program at Yale and the Johns Hopkins machine that feeds itself in the environment and all the various programs that do creative things, you put them all together, you might not have a robot, but you have something close enough to it to satisfy me. If you don't want to call it a robot, I don't know what else you would call it, except maybe sir. But Marvin Minsky proposed something a while ago that really fascinated me. I talked about a moment ago about using computers to create art, even if bad art. Minsky has a program for using computers to consume art, which I really think is a very attractive concept. You know, we writers can use all the markets we can find. Marvin's idea, he worked it out with a man named Seymour Papert, who used to be with Jean Piaget, the author of The Language and Thought of the Child. And what Minsky and Papert thought they were doing was to attempt to model the learning processes of a child in a computer program so that they could study the program, and if they wanted to do experiments on the learning of a child. They could do it on the program instead of on living children, which might cause some embarrassment with their parents in the law. So they prepared a program in which they told the computer little stories. Not exactly fairy tales, but children's stories. Stories like, Sally is coloring with her new crayons in her coloring book, and her big sister Alice comes in and says, "Oh, Sally, I love you so much and you're breaking my heart. Those pictures you're making are terrible, and it's because those crayons are no good. And because I love you, I want you to give me those crayons so you won't be messing up your pictures anymore." Then they ask the computer, "Does Alice really care about Sally's drawing? Or is she just trying to rip off the crayons?" And it turns out that to some extent the program can learn, much as a five-year-old child does learn, to recognize some sorts of information that are not explicit in what's stored. Minsky and some of the people associated with him in the artificial intelligence laboratory gave me the inspiration for part of another novel which has just been published called Gateway. They had a program of a mock psychological analysis session thing. The computer program they used did not respond to the spoken word, so you had to communicate by teletype. But apart from that, the transcript looked quite a lot like any good shrinky couch session. You'd say things like, "I feel very depressed," and the computer would type back, "Why are you depressed?" And you would say, "Because my mother doesn't love me," and it would say, "How do you feel about your mother?" And it would go on like that for quite a while. And of course, the computer really didn't understand what you were saying or care. It was only programmed to respond to certain keywords like depressed or mother or sex or whatever with the pre-programmed responses. But it seemed to me that this is not that far from what happens with most flesh and blood analysts. As one of them told me once, "What goes on in my head doesn't matter. It's what goes on in your head that contributes to the success of the analysis." And this being so, I invented a computer shrink for my novel, Gateway. He is called Siegfried von Schrink, as a matter of fact. And he's a pretty intelligent computer, and he does very well. Now, obviously, he would lack some of the advantages that we would like to associate with our human shrinks. He wouldn't be much fun to be rolfed by him. He would be no fun at all in a nude encounter session at Esalen. But something could be done about that. My friend and fellow science fiction writer James Gunn has a story about computer dating, which turns out to mean having sex with a computer. And I thought that was pretty far out until the other night when I saw a commercial for a new motion picture in which someone actually gets raped by a computer. I haven't seen the film, but it got the worst reviews I've ever seen. One of the difficulties with talking about computers in some circumstances is that many people have a terrible morbid fear of the computer. They know this thing goes over their tax returns and messes up their Diners Club charge bill, and there's all sorts of other things. Minsky had another idea once, which was to build very small robots and use them for all sorts of menial tasks that people can't be bothered with. One of them was to pick potato bugs off the vines so you wouldn't have to use insecticides. And it would have the further advantage that the bugs would be a pretty useful source of protein when things got really bad. And I mentioned this shortly after Minsky told me about it to an audience of undergraduates at, I think, the University of Wisconsin. And during the question period after it, one of the kids put his hand up and said, "You and Marvin Minsky might think that that's what they would use the little computers for. But I know what they would use them for. They would have them going through our dormitories looking for pot." And I think he might well be right. But I don't think that that's really at issue. I'm not really at all concerned about the computer as an enemy of civil liberties or individual freedom. I think that much depends on who uses it. Inspector Javert had no trouble hunting down Jean Valjean without any computer. In pre-war Russia and Germany, the dictatorships of Hitler and Stalin had no difficulty in keeping tabs on every individual without computers. I don't really think that we have much to fear from computers, however intelligent, at least not as much as we have to fear from human beings who think like computers. And I think there's a good deal too much of that around. What I would really like to talk about, among other things, is some of the science fiction stories that don't exactly relate to computers, but I'm not going to. I'm not even going to talk about some of the things that we science fiction writers think about and talk about a lot. I'm not going to talk about Star Trek. I'm not going to tell you whether Captain Kirk is really that way about Mr. Spock or any of the other things that I'm sure are pressing on many minds, because I see that I'm running a little longer than I planned to, and I know we want to see the film. But I promised one thing. I promised that I would explain to you what I meant by those preposterous remarks I made at the beginning about the people who come from the interior of another star. Carl Sagan pointed that out. He said, we have a pretty good idea of how the universe was formed, and it's pretty clear that in its first stages it was nothing but a mass of hydrogen gas, lightly tainted with helium and a few other light elements. And what happened was that in the original explosion or whatever that generated the universe, these gas clouds spread out into space and coalesced into stars. And in the interior of these stars, the nuclear processes cooked all of the heavier elements out of hydrogen. And then those stars, some of them, exploded as novas. And all the heavy elements everywhere in the universe originated in a star, including all of the calcium, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, phosphorus, and the rest of the things, except for the hydrogen, that goes up to make you and me. So the people, some part of whom came from the heart of a star, are all of us. And this seems to me to be a far more fantastic and wonderful thing than any number of little green men from Mars. And when I said that I could demonstrate the existence of ESP between human beings and machines, I think many of you will know how you do that. You simply put some electrodes on your head and watch your alpha waves on a cathode tube. And by, most people learn to control them. They can increase or decrease the frequency or the amplitude. Nobody quite knows how they do it. Some people say, I think of fleecy clouds and blue skies, and some people say, I grunt, and some people say other things. But in one way or another, most people do find that they can affect this extrasensory output from their brains, which does not go through any of the usual senses. And of course, once you do that, it's not too difficult to rig up a machine to respond to the amplitude of the frequency, make it go faster or slower, stop or start, so that there is some sort of ESP that can be demonstrated between human beings and machines. That may sound to you like a quibble. Huh? It is sort of a quibble. But there's one other kind of man-machine communication that I think is not a quibble, but something rather important. Suggested by John Platt at a conference I went to, sponsored by NASA a couple of years ago. And he called it the left-hand radio. Platt's idea was that you could put a radio transmitter on your wrist with little electrodes that went to the nerve centers of your hand, so that when you moved a muscle, the electrodes would pick up an impulse and transmit it to a receiver on someone else's wrist. also with electrodes that went to the nerve centers of his hand. So that if I wiggle my finger, your finger moves. So there is some sort of communication possible that way, which is not possible any other way. And that's sort of trivial too, but imagine what it would be like to have that sort of communication, not just with somebody's hand, but maybe with his whole body. Maybe with the body of a ballet dancer or a great athlete, or the fingers of Ruggiero Ricci when he's playing his Guarnerius, or Brailovsky playing Chopin, or any person doing something that you'd never done, didn't know how to do. This
for a person who's not eligible for a tax-sheltered annuity, I think that's probably a good measure. For a person who is eligible for a tax-sheltered annuity, I think another conception is necessary. Because the second level, the one above banking in this pyramid on which one is basing one's future, the tax-sheltered annuity is liquid to the point that within a matter of weeks, if not days, maybe a couple of weeks, 3 weeks at an average, one can have the money in hand.